Joe, you're back in the States. How are you doing?
Well, just fine, Tim. I'm, you know, to try to find a parallel for my last couple of months, you'd have to go into, Greek literature, maybe the Odyssey. I didn't get any, one-eyed monsters, but everything else came at me. Last 2 months, fire first, floods. I think God is telling me something, I'm not sure what, but and then in New Zealand, my wife is a hiker and nearly killed me a dozen times on these like cliff hikes she likes to go on. So I'm back in Montecito, and they let us in yesterday. The house had been completely unattended because it was at a mandatory evacuation zone.
Mm-hmm.
There's military control. There still actually are soldiers in the zones that are cordoned off still. But no one had been here, and so the house naturally fell apart at the seams, and so we've been trying to get it back together. And I walked some of the destruction today. It was the first time I actually had a chance to see it, and it's very strange because, say, 90% of Montecito, you wouldn't even know it had rained. I mean, it's just completely, you know, there's nothing. But along these creeks where we have built homes, as it turns out, perhaps foolishly, there's just complete destruction. I mean, I walked what's called Olive Mill. It's a street that runs near my house down to the ocean. And it was beyond belief. There were homes that had been literally crushed into debris. There were giant homes that had been taken off their foundations and rotated and moved around. Cars were in trees in some places, and then there were rocks, because it's characterized as a flood, but in fact, it's kind of a combination avalanche and flood. Large boulders are loosened, and then they roll down from the mountains. We're pressed up against these hills, or actually mountains. Some of them are almost 5,000 feet. And these things, particularly with water, they just get rolling, and they can't be stopped. They mm-hmm. just everything. And so what had been like an area where there are homes is now basically like a waterway with boulders and black mud. And it's just beyond belief. It was such a pristine, pretty, and upscale place. And now these little rivers that run through the community are devastated. And it's going to be interesting to see how they respond. I think it's going to be very, very complicated, the rebuilding of these areas, because the floods shut down Highway 101, which is California's basically not just major but only real commercial thoroughfare. It links San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, and to have it shut down like that is devastating. So I'm sure that the state will want to have Montecito, the waterways, and the permit system, where you have all these private bridges,
mm-hmm.
all these things can affect the water. You know, the bridges can become, if they're not designed properly, stopped up. You have a dam situation and then flash floods. The whole, concept here is to keep the water in the creek.
Yeah.
If it gets out of the creek, God help us, because the freeway is very low, and then you fill up the freeway. The freeway was under, parts of it, I would have to say, were 20 or 30 feet of mud. And so that's all been cleared out now. I mean, the local communities couldn't handle any of this, obviously. Way too big a project. So the Army Corps of Engineers came in, and they used dynamite. and C4, I think it is, it's called, or something. Yeah, it's C4, and they blew up boulders and would blow them up, have these huge earth-moving, tractors and bulldozers. And, I mean, these things are just enormous. And then they would get everything and put into big trucks, and the convoys of trucks were just nonstop. That's really why they evacuated the civilians, because the trucks were literally going nonstop through the community with these giant loads. They couldn't break. They had the kind of set up so that they could go right onto the freeway. And they wanted to get all of the debris cleared out so the waterways would work and not have the freeway flooded again. This was the mission. And this was, this is where the military really does well. You know, when it actually responds with its technology and manpower, they had thousands of people here. And so military can be a force of good, Tim, but sometimes not. I mean, sometimes we just are being brainwashed, it seems to me, to see our military in a positive light when, in fact, it's something else. I know you mentioned you'd read a book recently that talks about this. Would you like to give a little book report to us to start off the discussion on militarism and propaganda?
Sure. Militarism, of course, what stimulated this particular topic, I think, was I was watching some football games at my brother's house, and then a couple Sundays ago, and then all of a sudden, during the commercial break, they have these movies that are coming out soon, and so Hollywood appears to be in overdrive now, putting out these pro-military movies. I think there's one called 12 Strong regarding Afghanistan, the first people on the ground in Afghanistan to hunt bin Laden. So they're promoting the standard narrative of the war on terror and the heroic military going in there and justifying our now, what are, 17th or 18th year of occupation of that country?
Well, they committed 9/11, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it was the Afghan.
We have to stop that. So we went in and occupied. Yeah.
And then there was, right after that, there was an ad for what Clint Eastwood's latest flick, Tribute to the Empire, and that it's the 1517 to Paris. I guess his story about these three or four soldiers who apparently took out a crazed Muslim on a train in France, and I guess that justifies all the military spending, the 1,000 military bases and all that, of the United States U.S. Empire, because, once again, heroic U.S. soldiers are saving Europe from savages. So that, got me thinking, they ruled these films out, and of course, Clint Eastwood also did American Sniper a few years ago. We have these films, but the book, the book is The Complex by Nick Terse. It's a very good book. The full title's The Complex, How the Military Invades Our Everyday Lives, and basically it shows just the cultural, economic impact of military spending. And there's a great introduction here that he writes about just an everyday life, a morning of a typical couple. And I'll just read this. He says, Rick is a mid-level manager in a financial service company in New York City. Each day he commutes from Weehawken, New Jersey, a suburb only a stone's throw from the Big Apple, where he lives with his wife, Donna. The sound there. Donna and his teenage son, Stephen. A late baby boomer, Rick just missed the Vietnam era's anti-war protests, but he's been against the war in Iraq from the beginning. He thinks the Pentagon is out of control and considers the military-industrial complex a danger to the country. If you asked him, it's a subject on which he would rate himself as knowledgeable. He puts effort into educating himself on such matters. He reads liberal websites, subscribes to progressive-minded magazines, and is a devotee of Jon Stewart's Daily Show. Yeah, that's... it's typical, yeah. In fact, he has no idea just how deep the Pentagon rabbit hole goes or how far down his family already is. Rick believes that despite its long reach, the military-industrial complex is a discrete entity far removed from his everyday life. Now, if this were 1961 when the outgoing President Dwight D. Eisenhower warned the country about the unwarranted influence of the military-industrial complex and the large arms industry already firmly entrenched in the United States, Rick might be right. After all, he doesn't work for one of the Pentagon's corporate partners like arms maker Lockheed Martin. He isn't in the Army Reserve. He's never attended a performance of the Marine Corps band, not to mention the Army, Navy's Air Force music groups. But today's geared up high-tech complex is nothing like the olive drab outfit of Eisenhower's day. It reaches deep into American lives and American psyche than Eisenhower could have ever imagined. The truth is that at every turn, in countless not-so-visible ways, Rick's life is wrapped up with the military. So wake up with Rick and sample a single autumn morning as the alarm on his Sony, Department of Defense contractor, clock interrupts his final dream of the night. Donna is already up and dressed in the fitness apparel by Danskin, a Pentagon supplier that received over $780,000 in DoD dollars in 2004 and another $456,000 in 2005, and Haynes Her Way, made by the defense contractor and cake seller Sara Lee Corporation, which took in over $68 million from the DoD in 2006. Committed to a healthy lifestyle, she's wearing sneakers from DoD contractor New Balance and briskly jogging on a treadmill made by DoD contractor True Fitness Technology. Rick drags himself into the bathroom, fixtures by Pentagon contractor Kohler, purchased at the defense contractor Home Depot. Though he squeezes the Charmin, brushes with Crest toothpaste, and washes his face with Noxzema, then hopping into the shower, lathers up with zest and chooses Donna's Herbal Essence over Head and Shoulders. What the hell, he matters, I deserve an organic experience. The manufacturer of each of these products, Procter & Gamble, is among the top 100 defense contractors and raked in a cool $362,461,808 from the Pentagon in 2006. In his DoD supplier Bausch & Lomb contact lenses, and down goes a Zantac for his ulcer from DoD contractor GlaxoSmithKline. Heading back to the bathroom, he finds Donna finished with her workout and making the bed with the TV news on, and lends her a hand. Their headboard was purchased from Thompsonville Furniture, the mattress from Sears. Pillows were made by Harris Pillow Supply, all Pentagon contractors. They exchange grim glances as one of their Samsung set, another DoD contractor. The Today Show chronicles the latest in the chaos in Iraq. Thank God we never supported this war, Rick says, thinking of the anti-war rally Donna and he attended even before the invasion was launched. NBC, which produces the Today Show, is owned by General Electric, the 14th largest defense contractor in the United States, to the tune of $2.3 billion from the DoD in 2006, and has worked on such weapons as the UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter and the FA-18 Hornet multi-mission fighter attack aircraft, both of use in Iraq. So, you get the gist there, right?
it's clear.
Yeah. Pretty much the defense spending in the United States is so huge, and it gets into every aspect of American life, whether it's research and development, product development, and a lot of these consumer items that we do use were first, of course, developed for the military, and they're really, we can't get it out of our lives because it's so pervasive.
Indeed. I wanted to back up just one second, mention that this individual, you know, who is seemingly, is being characterized as someone sort of unwittingly participating in the military complex that runs the United States, or at least is being characterized as such. But he watches Jon Stewart.
Yes.
Right? And that really made me laugh because, yeah. I mean, there is a lifetime actor if ever one existed. He's a classic. Should well be studied, you know, by the citizens, because that little piece of work, he has all these jokes and, you know, very lovable in so many ways. And then when 9/11 comes along, suddenly he's not so funny. And, he's very much lampooning and ridiculing people who are trying to reach the truth about that. Mm-hmm. So... And then, you know, you look into his background, elite Jewish family, you know, his brother's like one of the big financial players in the United States. So, you know, it's just, it stinks. And And that individual that you mentioned, you know, he's not only is his soul being sucked out of him by all of the products and the financial, you know, ization of the military into our lives, but the propaganda is hitting him. He doesn't even know, you know, that he is basically enslaved by the system. And so all of these things that you mentioned, and that's, I think, really, yeah, that was just a great description, you know. This is a good book of what Americans don't see, of how the military has reached out and is, you know, controlling our lives, all the products. And that individual, he doesn't understand that his whole world, his wealth, his time, his consciousness, it's all actually to some extent under control by the group that controls the military.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how to wake the guy up? Well, you got to get him off the Xanax, you know, and onto the heroin. I don't know what to do with someone like that. You know, I was thinking about that okay, so you have such an individual. He's very much the everyman of our country. But how could someone like that ever, you know, get out of all of the fabric that he lives with him? You know, every product, you know, the TV shows. I mean, it's just everything has been weaponized against him. And unless you get that spark awareness that this is the case, you're just going to stay in that matrix and be controlled. You see, he's going to end up, someone like that would have a hard time not ending up basically as a patriot, basically as someone who would come to see America in a positive light. You know, yeah, we're fighting, you know, in this war, but I don't think someone like that could ever rebel, because I think the propaganda is just effective enough to keep him in a kind of numb living death. You know, I mean, he's like one of these creatures that are captured by a spider and then kept alive in the web for the babies to eat. You know, it's just a grisly situation to think of him. And I had recently, I didn't see the movie, but I've been studying it, and I intend to. But there's a new movie out called Pitch Perfect 3. And I mentioned, you know, that to you before the show.
I read the article you sent me.
Yeah, that it's, you know, it's portrayed as a musical. But in fact, there is just complete relationship now between Hollywood, the Pentagon, the CIA, and the NSA.
Mm-hmm.
And there are documents which have been exposed showing that this relationship exists. And then when you see a show like this, and this is a little different to me, and this is something I wanted to mention, is that it seems like the propaganda is getting more blatant, I think, which is interesting. You know, it's like, is this because they're worried about the alternative media? This is how they're going to respond to it. But it's also more clear in the sense that the DOD, the Department of Defense, is basically given credit as like helping produce the movie, because the army is involved with the creation of the films. And what you see then with Pitch Perfect 3 is something that can be studied as a propaganda piece. You know, you had sent me a video of that contained really old footage that was the DOD had influence in. And they gave video of a TV show called Lassie.
Yeah, that was funny, wasn't it?
Right. You know, so they show Lassie, and in the show that is being referenced in the film, you know, Lassie rescues this guy from a plane that broke down, and Lassie figures out something is wrong with the engine because Lassie can hear the high pitch whine that indicates there's some mechanical defect. And so Lassie is a hero. That was the original script, but it was shown to the army because they wanted, the TV show producer wanted some help in like having a an Army Cessna basically used in the footage. And the Army said, well, okay, we're fine with it, except for the fact we can't have to change the story because we can't have kids seeing an Army piece of equipment fail.
Yeah, no.
Because even this was in the 1950s, even then, they were trying to indoctrinate children into this idea that there was something magical and perfect about the military. And that was very telling, that kind of very subtle child propaganda was going on in the 50s.
Yeah, because Timmy there saluting at the end, where he salutes the colonel.
Yeah.
Innocently saluting the colonel. He's the one that's going to be dragooned into fighting in Vietnam a decade later.
That little drug punk is going to be in the Mekong Delta.
Yeah. Listen to Fortunate Son by CCR or Jimi Hendrix or something.
just stoned out of his mind, And so this is it starts with something so innocent, but then it ends up, in face down in the mud in the Mekong Delta. And so needs to be exposed. In Pitch Perfect, they actually take the whole show onto a military base, which is completely absurd. It had nothing to do with the actual storyline, but they move the whole thing into a military base, and the military base is portrayed basically as a kind of a Disneyland. You have a handsome, sexy serviceman. You've got all kinds of this patriotism where people are like civilians are coming up thanking the soldiers for their service and heroism and protecting us against, the crazed fanatics in the Middle East, that are, mm-hmm. are almost at our shores. They even threw in, of course, the required lesbian character, right?
Yeah,
who's now going to enlist, because, hey, gay people can also be heroes, And so it's very blatant propaganda. they actually, in the article that I had read, which was written by Caitlin Johnstone, and she's in has a blog called medium.com, and she had pointed out that the military individuals who had been involved with it had come up with quotes, and that they're basically in no uncertain terms taking credit for creating the story. And so they cite this one guy, Captain Meredith Kirchhoff, that the film humanizes the human resources used to power the American war machine. we have a real problem, don't we, when the characterization that we have of the military comes from Hollywood, because Hollywood is basically just reflecting the propaganda that the military is trying to sell the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course you mentioned Hollywood's liaising or meeting with the military. That goes back to almost Hollywood's founding with the War Department, with the movie Wings, the silent film, then Hell's Angels, the Howard Hughes film. Of course, in the 30s, particularly, then we don't run to the Second World War. You had things like Sergeant York coming out in 1941, glorifying America's entry into World War One, and denigrating ideas of pacifism. Of course, you've Casablanca, although it came out in 1942, it had been produced in 1941, and this, of course, that shows how impossible it is for any good American to be isolationist. You must be an interventionist.
Right.
You can't afford to stay out of it. That's the whole idea behind Casablanca and these things. And so, those who know about the Disney Corporation know that the War Department pretty much took it over throughout the war, and then Disney films produced a whole bunch of propaganda films, cartoons. They helped develop the maps that people saw in the newsreels and these things. A lot of the morale boosting films, they call it, I guess you could say, would be like Donald Duck cartoons telling people to pay their taxes and put up with the rationing and these things. That's of course, that was for the Treasury Department. So all these propaganda films and that type of partnership never ended. In fact, after the war, it sort of was formalized. The CIA, of course, itself had connections to filmmaking. Of course, the OSS itself, I think, produced a film. It's called OSS, I think. I think Tom Secker did some research. Tom Secker has done some great research on this, actually, out of the UK, about national security. I think they have a book called National Security Cinema that details this stuff, that kind of gets collates and organizes all the research they've done throughout the years regarding the military and national security state and Hollywood. But yeah, this movie, I think it was called OSS, and it glorified the exploits of the OSS during the war and the role it played in defeating the evil Axis powers. And I think in one of the films, there's some sort of operation going down. And this is, I think, this is a post-war film, but it's supposed to be taking place in, I think it was made in 1945 or 44, maybe even during the war. I forget what. But anyway, the actual term Central Intelligence, we need a Central Intelligence Agency, is actually used in the film. this is before 1947. So they're promoting the necessity not only for the military, but also for a permanent, cryptocracy, an intelligence agency, because I think the focus of the film was show just how far America was behind its adversaries in having, lawless, secretive cryptocracies that can cloak and dagger stuff, that can go out and fight the dirty wars that are necessary defend and expand democracy, defend the free world. That type of programming, it's in the films. We need a Central Intelligence Agency. And lo and behold, a few years later.
Just have one of those. Just let's have it immediately.
Yeah.
It's funny when I was reading some of the propaganda arcs of how the relationship, kind of the broadest stroke I saw, the one I thought might be amusing for the listeners to cogitate upon, is Bimbo's Initiation, which was created by Max Fleischman but it featured Mickey Mouse. It actually had Walt's character. So Walt and Fleischman were working together, though Fleischman is the one who's credited with creating it and producing it, but clearly Disney was involved. And since Bibno's Initiation is an obvious homage to a Freemason, the way that they're able to basically control people, it's not particularly, symbolic. It's just what the thing is about. It really kind of shows, and of course, Fleischman and Disney were both Masons, right? So they have the secret society background. And then Walt, of course, pops up again in just after World War II in the secret military base in Laurel Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, that's really interesting because, you also have, from there you have David Crosby, Jim Morrison, and Peter Fonda.
Oh, Henry's. Yeah.
Now, this is very interesting because so you have, these are all hippies and proponents of drug taking. I mean, Easy Rider was just, an obvious propaganda piece to shatter the family. And it was the other side of the jaws of destruction around the generation, the other being the Vietnam War. But did you know that Henry Fonda was an intelligence officer during World War II? And so this is very interesting because, Jim Morrison's father, the high-ranking admiral, the guy who oversaw the Gulf of Tonkin false flag, Frank Zappa's father, MKUltra chemist, high-level military intelligence, and then David Crosby, his dad was OSS. And so when you look at these arcs, right, between generation and product, the different kinds of films they make, from Bimbo's Initiation to Easy Rider, you can see that the military propaganda is not just the glorification of war. It's also different ways to basically control the population, to make them servile. So, and it's unified. The propaganda on one side comes at us, you know, as like, a, for example, the counterculture creation. But on the other side, you get the glorification of the task of the United States. And even though these two things are often shown as a dialectic, like they're in competition, it ends up in exactly the same place for both groups.
Are you suggesting Jane Fonda was not the real deal?
Well, I'll tell you, the first 5 minutes of Barbarella had me convinced. I still can't believe that she's an agent. But I would think that, you see, this is how I see the system.
But Joe, Jane Fonda went to Vietnam, and she, you know, she
see, there it is, you know, and her brother was, you know, glorifying drug taking and communal living and the shattering of family. And they're clearly rebelling from Henry, aren't they? You know,
yes.
Who is a staid individual, and there could never be some kind of relationship between the two camps. But yeah, I actually think it's all just done as
as theater. You know, yeah, Peter and Jane are as different from their father as David Crosby was different from his father, as that photograph showed, right?
Exactly right. Yeah, they're so different. It's just incredible how different they are, and yet it all ends up kind of in the same place. And so it's sort of like Gloria Steinem, you know, as you know, this couldn't possibly be something that would be in the would be against the actual lives of the American women, right? Mm-hmm. She's so earnest trying to fight for it. So the propaganda is pretty complicated, and it's hard to see. But I would just say that. You really have to be really skeptical of anyone who has a kind of generational relationship into either military intelligence or into Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Because, you see, I just don't think it works in the way people are told. I mean, I don't think, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones are, you know, the result of hard work and talent. You know, I think that they are the result of a decision being made to take culture, to take European youth culture into a more integrated world, and that's going to be part of the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll separation from ethnic communities, which were obviously a problem for the oligarchs and had to be destroyed.
Well, the military is a huge part of that, just the war itself, because just the social engineering aspect of mobilization, the draft, and pulling all the boys from the farms and sending them overseas into Asia and Europe and the Pacific, then bringing them back. They're not going to go back to the farm. How do you get the boy back in the farm once he's seen Gay Paris, as they said during World War One? And so just the huge, just the trauma from war, not just the war itself, but just the cultural trauma, being pulled away from your family for 3, 4, or 5 years. That's going to separate you from your family. That's going to destroy, deracinate you, so to speak, and you're going to come back, and all of a sudden, everyone's become more mobilized. The military itself, because, well, the interstate highway system, according to the standard narrative, was a result of Eisenhower being impressed with the Autobahn, supposedly, and being designed for military reasons. Although it really never was designed for military reasons, it was designed to disperse the population, get them out of the cities. And in the suburbia, you can just tell how they're designed. They're not there to accommodate military equipment. But there was a huge social engineering feat right there. America was far different in 1940 than it was in 1950. And I don't think you can, it's probably just as profound 1940 to 1950 as it was between 1960 and 1970. And just as in 1960, 1970, there was a lot of social engineering and planning going on there. Well, same with World War II, and that was foreseen back in the early part of the 20th century. When you get with Norman Dodd and his investigation into the foundations, where that investigator, Catherine Casey, undercovered the minutes from the Carnegie, I think it was the Carnegie Foundation, where they determined that war was the best way to fundamentally change, collectivize society and these things. And lo and behold, I think that was like 1910, 1908 around, in the next 30, 40 years, you're at war. And World War One, World War Two, then Korea, the police action, then Vietnam, the undeclared war, constant war. Just think about the amount of trauma and what it does to the economy. The entire state of California, pretty much what we know, modern California, was built around entertainment and the military-industrial complex. And the two played off each other.
That's right. You know. And that's one thing I really think that I'm glad you're bringing up is that the fact that there is this seeming opposition. You know, you have Peter Fonda and Henry Fonda. You have Jim Morrison and Admiral Morrison. And you have David Crosby and Colonel, whatever his name, Floyd Crosby, right? And you go, well, it's a free country. Look, the youth are rebelling, right? But actually, they're just conducting another phase of the operation of enslavement.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and so that's the. It's sort of like the problem that people have looking at Donald and Hillary. If they can get you to hate one of these two individuals, they've won,
mm-hmm.
because their dramatic production has created a sense of reality, right? If you hate either Hillary or the Donald, you have been brainwashed successfully, because now in the election you will you may not like what goes on in the country, but by God, you know, the person you hate either won or lost, and so you mistake that for the idea of democracy, which is basically the illusion of freedom. You know, I mentioned last week that the oligarchs don't rule, in spite of the Constitution. They rule because of it. They have control over us because they're able to manipulate this particular set of laws so easily. It's designed for them to be able to manipulate the different electoral systems inside our country, so they can just control the political apparatus. But the public doesn't know they're being enslaved because they think that the Constitution is there to protect them. I actually spent, when I came back from New Zealand, I was there in Los Angeles. We couldn't come back home and I had nothing to do. So all I did was play over and over again the preamble to our last show where you described the American political system. I just thought that was so brilliant. I sometimes I would laugh till tears would roll down my cheeks, and other times I would cry. I mean, that's something everyone should understand, the sarcasm, how brilliant that particular vignette is. If you can just listen to it, you really get a sense of how the wool's pulled over the people's eyes. So what we're talking about today, the militarism, you can't talk about any of these things, militarism, the counterculture, feminism, you know, you can't talk about them in isolation. They don't operate in an isolated sense. They operate in unity. It's the overall package. It's both Henry, crotchety old American patriot, the drug crazed Peter Fonda on listening to it, like driving his motorcycle with Born to Be Wild.
Mm-hmm.
And God help me, it's Jane Fonda at the beginning of Barbarella with the clothes off floating in space. It's all part of the same thing, you see. But if you make the mistake of thinking, well, Peter and Jane have rebelled, haven't they? You see, it's a free country. Look, there's rebellion. Then you're missing the whole way that you're being programmed. And it's just like with Trump and Hillary. If you hate one or the other, you've already basically lost control of your mind,
mm-hmm.
because they're it's all fake. You're literally mistaking a theatrical production as something that's real, and you can't, you know, never succeed in this world with that blunder. You know, it just the world is too vicious. There's too many. People that are out trying to enslave, and if you don't think clearly, you're going to be lost. And you know, and so that's why militarism is really valuable to understand. When we see the giant flags, you know, covering the entire stadiums now, you know, in football games, whatnot, they're definitely trying to, you know, promote war, normalize us as the citizens of a warfare state. But when you see Jon Stewart make jokes, you know, about Donald Trump, you're also being exposed to the same system of propaganda. In that case, it's just trust development, so that when the, you know, the key issue comes, like 911, Stewart can come in with his control over your mind and say, "Well, 911 is, it's the people who are truthers are crazy, right?"
And do it in humor. What they do is, they don't really address it in a substantive, serious debate, because they couldn't handle it, so they ridicule. And
Like we talk about Tucker Carlson, you know, mm-hmm. the Lifetime actor, and you mentioned that you know, he was asked about Building 7's collapse, and I can't quote him, but I mean the gist was is that he just said, well, of course these things can happen accidentally, because it did happen.
Yeah,
right. He just, you know, basically the almost like an insane logical fallacy, right? It's mm-hmm. just absurd. But you know, his position of authority enables him to get away with stuff like that. It's like Noam Chomsky, where you know, he's so lovable and he's got this bizarre, uncomprehensible kind of theories of how sentences are structured and whatever this is. So he's sort of smart and he's sweet and he's calm. And then he talks about, you know, 911, and he goes, well, you know, these things happen. It's just that all of these little weird details, like the building collapsing symmetrically at free fall speed, and you know, that just happens. It just happens, Tim.
Well, he gets credibility because he'll raise some interesting, good points about various topics, so American militarism, American empire, and these things.
Exactly.
Selectively. Yeah. Same with Tucker Carlson. He'll bring on some crazy feminist or some social justice warrior, make a fool out of him, and that gets everyone going, yeah, well, I can trust Tucker. He's great. Look at Tucker. You know, I can trust Noam.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's just like I can hate Hillary.
Yeah.
I can hate the Donald, so it must be a real election. I mean, is this clear? I hope everyone, you know, that listened to us, because it's just it's a pretty simple point.
And it also, of course, it distracts from much, you know, who's really calling the shots or what interests are really calling the shots. And yeah, I think I suggested that maybe perhaps another topic might be who they is. Yeah,
absolutely. That's critical, because it's all part of the same thing.
Because I ran into that over the weekend. They were talking about some relatives were talking about. They always think about who they is, and they ask, who's they? And I go, oh, I don't know, B'nai B'rith ADL. Does that work for you? Do you want to go into it?
Family, the elite Jewish banking family, skull and bones. I mean, I whenever I get hit with that,
Council of Foreign Relations.
I don't let go of it. I say, okay, well, I'm glad you asked that, and then I give them like 50 people, you know. And I go, and by the way, here's another list, you know, that I want you to say. So they really is like, it's sort of like this idea that there can't be a conspiracy that uses the government because government is too incompetent, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they go, well, how could the government do that? I mean, they can't even like get the tax structure right, you know? So, I mean,
well, the tax structure is the way it is because it's supposed to be the way it is.
Right, exactly. But the whole thing is that the public, without the understanding of the secret society, without the understanding of them, brother, you're just lost. You are lost in this world. You cannot understand it. It makes no sense. You might have, I mean, maybe you can root for the Chicago Cubs and hate Hillary Clinton, but that's about as far as you can go intellectually. You can't really understand it if you don't have that basic structure. And militarism is a good portal, very good point to get in on. Because when you see it, it's so blatant, then it's a way for people to go, you know, there has to be something more in back of it. How can the military, which supposedly is under this democratic control, please listen to Tim's preamble to the show last week to get an understanding of how the system was supposed to operate. Since the military is supposed to be under democratic control, how can it do things like that to damage the minds of the civilians? Well, it can't. And the fact that you have things like MK Ultra and Operation Mockingbird and the participation of the U.S. military in all of these just blatantly illegal activity is because it isn't under the control of democracy at all, right? That means that there is a system of control that's invisible, inside the thing. It has to exist. It does exist. We don't understand the real connections that the secret society has through the generals, the chiefs of staff. I mean, they're probably family members, ethnic, you know, cryptos or whoever are people who have taken oaths. Because, you know, like we were talking about, well, how war is good just for the kind of mental process that breaks people down. And that's one of the reasons I'm sure that the oligarchs continue the wars as they do. There's a number of reasons, but one of them just has to be to put humans in a situation where they have agreed to be broken down mentally and becoming and become robots.
Yeah, well, more or less kind of like a nationwide boot camp psychologically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have to follow orders because we're all depending on you know instant obedience.
Don't you know there's a war on? How dare you ask questions?
Yeah. Don't question a damn thing. Just you know, pull a grenade pin and throw it into the families. You know, So
I mean, this is acknowledged because even during World War II, it's acknowledged that information was censored as Office of War Information for the purposes of morale. That all this, what the thing is, they're not going to give you all the information. So you, as a citizen, when you vote, write your congressman or hold your public officials accountable, are going to have all the information necessary to determine whether or not it's a good idea to go to war or to stay at war, because the people who are conducting war will determine that that itself is it will be bad for morale. So when they say things like politics ends at the water's edge, these things, well, what? No. But that's the whole myth of democratic control of these things, because the public is never given the information it needs if it had the inclination to think about these things in mass, to hold their elected officials accountable, and not to mention the military, you know, because that's the whole myth behind democratic control, as if millions and millions of Americans who are busy working or distracted with entertainment are going to spend time, you know, scrutinizing public policy, following news stories, looking for inconsistencies, whether or not the news follow up on one story or other, whether or not a news story even makes sense, it's true, or, you know, once scandal's reported, well, do they follow up on the scandal? I mean, if there are reports of atrocities committed overseas by U.S. troops and it's reported one time somewhere, is the public going to say, hey, wait a second, you're not talking about that today, you talked about it yesterday, why aren't you talking about
well,
today?
Well, you can't damage the morale of the soldiers, for God's sake. Which side of the war are you on?
You know, no one can follow this stuff. I mean, I would just think the other day, I was just reading about an article about Syria, about what's going on in there, and you know, Trump announced that he's going to maintain troops in Syria, the border there, and they're going to support, I guess, Kurdish army. And right. I'm thinking, well, you support the Kurds. The problem with that is the Kurds are trying to break away from Turkey, and Turkey is a member of NATO, and that could break NATO up if you do this because they don't want Kurdish independence. These things. At the same time, you're destabilizing Syria. You're hurting Turkey, which is one reason or another is a NATO member. And I'm reading through this article, different names, thinking, okay, this is like no one when people voted for Trump, they didn't say I'm going to vote for Trump because he's going to foment the civil war in Syria to take out the Assad regime. But it's happening anyway.
What happened to globalism, Trump?
Yeah, globalism. Thank you. But right. Then it goes just the amount of detail in this article. You know, I forget. I mean, I follow these things rather closely, but even then, I forget the detail of these things. And after a while, it all kind of blends into just one like gray blob of information. If you don't just think of it from a public standpoint, is the public's not going to hold the people accountable because the press, which we've talked about. That we rely on, supposedly, the Fourth Estate to distill this information for us and inform us, is totally controlled by the military and the intelligence agencies. Because those agencies are controlled by the financial interests that rule the roost, who are ultimately controlled by a handful of oligarchic families. And that's the power structure. I mean, so...
Okay, well, Tim, I have to confess. I have a little piece of vanity. I regard myself as sort of an expert in the Middle East, particularly the wars.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time. I can't make hide or hair out of it.
Yeah.
If you ask me, who's I would have no clue. There are organizations that pop up, Hamas, you know, I mean, who are they? You study them. What happens? I mean, basically, I kind of think what you're seeing there is almost like a World War I thing, where it's the whole purpose of it is just to, you know, is to basically kill Muslims, right? And to come up with completely cockamamie ideas to give the public as to why this is being done. Mm-hmm. I think that there really isn't any, you know, I mean, I don't believe that things like ISIS exist without the authorization and funding, right, of the oligarch families. Mm-hmm. So there is a purpose for them, and there's a that is, you know, a propaganda purpose. But then when you look at sort of like the, you know, different groups inside Syria, even Assad himself, some of the behavior that he exhibits, man, I smell a rat. I think that in the world of militarism, you know, absolutely pseudo rationale for just genocide are easy to slip over the public. And I think, I mean, if, you know, I was making a joke about being vain, because actually I don't know, I can't understand anything that goes on there, because I don't think there's anything to understand. Mm-hmm. I think it goes to understand what's going on, you have to look far deeper into what the oligarchs intend for the region. And therefore, the way that they get to that point, every single thing, every element, every, you know, the Yemen situation, the Saudi Arabia is now, you know, battling here. All of this is nonsense. All of the rationale, it's all just population reduction over a long term. You're going to end up with the Muslims being moved out, and greater Israel, you know, from the Nile to the Euphrates will, and beyond. That's what the phrase actually, you know, states. So that's really what is going to be the end result. That's what the oligarchs want. And everything that goes on in between is just, you know, cockamamie tactical propaganda maneuvers.
Yeah, but Joe, it's very important that we have hundreds of thousands of troops stationed overseas, because every once in a while they might go on a train and stop a terrorist attack, like in Paris.
So, you know, I just wanted to say, now, Clint Eastwood, I mean, isn't senility the grounds for, like, not having someone be a director of a movie? I mean, did you see him at the Academy Awards a couple years ago where he was just tottering? I mean, it looked like he was just propped up by, you know, on meds and a, you know, on a stick. I mean, he just looked like he was absolutely brain dead. I didn't think he would make it to the after.
Are you saying Clint Eastwood is kind of like Colonel Sanders now or something? They just put him up there?
Yeah, I think he's, I'm not even sure he's alive at this point. I mean, that the idea of making a movie about that is, it, you know, I mean, you know, it's like really one thing we should do maybe is having a Tim and Joe Academy Awards for the best propaganda movies of the year. Mm-hmm. And like in mine, I mean, certainly a few years ago, Zero Dark Thirty would have been, I mean, that was really, you know, you have a completely fictional account of a fictional account, and it's given as reality. And I actually had an argument, or sort of, about this guy about the nature of the bin Laden attack, and he was using Zero Dark Thirty as his groundwork for his position. And it was like, at a certain point, I was going, God, you know, this is just an exercise in insanity.
Well, he saw it. You saw it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I saw it.
His own two eyes. He saw it.
It was real. It's, you know, so that's the thing, is that if you don't have that flame, you know, that spark of skepticism that, you know, that this could be propaganda, you are really vulnerable. You know, you're so vulnerable. And so, you know, step out of the matrix and into the sunlight you know, it starts with, you know, when the militarism occurs. What do you think, Tim? I mean, you're sitting there, you know, you're drinking a few beers. You know, it's a propaganda piece. A lot of the people that listen to us would know that. You know, they see the giant flag come over and the jets and things, and no one says anything. What should a person in that situation say to the people in the room? What would be effective? You know, or is there anything you can do?
Wake the hell up. I mean, it's like, you know, here's this movie, 17:15 to Paris, whatever the title is.
I think it was the 7:15 to Paris.
7:15 to Paris. Yeah. Here is a dramatization of an event which, are you sure it happened at all? I mean, it's like this is what happens. They make a dramatization of an event which was probably staged, so now you have a dramatization of a staged event. And so this sort of sanctifies or confirms in the mind of people, they may think to themselves, well, I'm watching a movie, which may not be totally real because it's a movie, and that'd make it interesting. But the event's
based on a real event?
Yeah, like Tora, 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 right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is that, so, you know, movies are very effective in terms of mind control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a lot of details known about the studio that was set up in Laurel Canyon, but enough can be inferred, you know, by the people who were in, that they were studying pornography, they were studying special effects. And then they were probably also studying the effects of music, you know, in video, seeing how it could be used.
Yeah, that's.
And then that's why, you know, that's why the Laurel Canyon music's been, you know, was literally, I mean, within 100 yards of the facility, it just pops to life, you know. And so that would be the level of sophistication you're dealing with. And now we've got this double and tripling, you know, where you have the fictional event covered by the fictional media, and then Hollywood makes a movie based on a real event, and so that becomes what history is. And that's what people know of history. You know, they see with militarism, you have to just bear in mind that you have to understand it as propaganda, but you should also look at it as something that's, you know, part of a broader structure, and it can, and there can just because something is opposed to militarism, like Noam Chomsky, doesn't mean that you know it's not part of the process of mind control and enslavement.
Yeah, it's important because if you read Christopher Simpson's book, The Science of Coercion, and he focuses a lot on the development of mass communication starting in the late 1930s. Of course, he focuses on the radio research project out of Princeton, Hadley Cantrell, right, and the War of the Worlds Halloween Eve broadcast, October 3rd, 1938. That's an interesting year and timing for that. The effects of a fake broadcast, not just the effect of the broadcast itself, but also the exaggeration, the reported exaggeration of people's reaction to that was followed by these these people spending a lot of time and money gauging and charting the public's response to these things and the effects of mass communication. And in that book, Christopher Simpson says the whole study and therefore the development of mass communication was all funded by the War Department, the military, and after the Second World War, the CIA. For the purposes,
right, exactly.
Mass communication was developed for the purpose of mass manipulation and psychological warfare. This also coincides with development of the Psychological Strategy Board and C.D. Jackson in the Eisenhower administration, and the development of certain film and also radio and music. And I think even outfits like EMI, which would later would produce records for the Beatles, were all tied to the military in Britain. And the same thing, if you go with the Columbia Studios, these things, record company, these in the United States, all these big corporations, all tied into Columbia Broadcasting Corporation, these things. So it's all tied into the national security state.
Yeah, William Paley, who's Jewish, OSS guy, and you can just see these threads. They're not really that hard to follow. I don't want to,
I mean, Elvis Presley. Remember, we did a show on Elvis Presley based on the Miles Mathis article. His manager, Tom Parker, got into the country, took the name of the soldier that let him in illegally, right?
I know, completely absurd, right?
He looks like a spook. If you just look at his life, he looks like he's a spook, and he's managing off Elvis Presley,
right?
You know,
and so you can see that our culture is just the way it works is not as people think. the basic component they got to realize is that the individual is not in front of you because there was some kind of market that he has won. In other words, Elvis Presley wasn't, you know, good dancer, attractive looking guy. I guess he had a pretty good singing voice. That's not why he's up there. Mm-hmm. That's why he is the one who the media is presenting. He is the one the media is presenting because they are doing something to your mind, and he is the device that they've chosen to use. The Beatles, this wasn't just someone trying to sell a bunch of records. This was someone trying to wreck a bunch of minds, right? This is what this is about. And so you have to automatically, when you see celebrity, be suspicious. Every time there is a celebrity, every time you see Jane Fonda floating naked in space, you know, you have to go, okay, she's attractive. And, you know, my mind, it's hard to focus, you know, when she's on screen like this. But, you know, there is probably a reason why she's there. There's probably a reason that an oligarch has for this precise image coming to you. Hollywood wasn't created, you know, to basically sell movie tickets. You know, when Wilbur Hayes was going around the country under the cover of the production code and getting every single small town to have a movie theater in it, you know, every single small town should have resisted and burned the thing to the ground.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's there to understood what the evil was in back of this entire industry of Hollywood.
It's there to enslave you to your passions and appetites, which makes you a slave, because then again, you lose your critical faculty or your these things, and if you become enslaved to your passions and desires, you become a consumer, and then and you're in a position now to be sold something.
And well, basically, you're on the way to genocide. Look, there are two principles that you have to operate under. Everything else is, and those are strength and virtue. Right, that's it. Strength and virtue. These are the characteristics of you know, successful humans.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to find happy, well, you know, find Kim Kardashian. Maybe she'll give you some opiates, you know.
Yeah, and they're there to market goods, because Kardashian wears a certain perfume. They'll market the perfume.
Yeah, well, and also they're there to market a certain consciousness.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, this giddy kind of, you know, giggling opioid fused, you know, mindlessness is actually something that's valuable. You know, the happy thing it's one of the Hollywood things that they sell to keep people basically moving forward toward genocide. But it's the exact opposite of what the people need to develop, which is just the two things. They got to be strong and they got to be virtuous.
And the destruction of ethnic consciousness, because that's one thing the military does too, because it breaks you down, right?
Right. Yeah. It gets rid of all that.
Gets everyone. You know, we hear stories about, you know, the platoon in Vietnam. There's a guy with an Italian name. There's a black guy. There's a Polish name. And then there's an Irish name. And this is America. And we've been sold that this is America. We're all deracinated. We have no ethnic consciousness. And that was a function of the military, because before that, America was pretty much a confederation of different ethnic communities, particularly in the North. And this
each of them that had tremendous political power and could resist the oligarchy.
Basically, they won't sign on to the empire, the new, you know, the American century, Henry Luce's American century, because they had different interests than the Eastern Seaboard elite that Henry Luce represented, and these things with Skull and Bones and all that stuff. But you'll see that with, and again, the thing is, they'll pathologize ethnic consciousness. Meaning, good example, Italian ethnic consciousness is pathologized in the role of the mafia, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So that's pathologized. It's abusive fathers.
German ethnic.
Well, that's the ultimate, isn't it?
It's pathologized in the role of the Nazi.
Goose stepping brown shirts and Nazis.
Anyone who knows, the trajectory from, British Zionism through Helen Blavatsky and the Thule Society into the so-called Nazi Party with all the occultism, This is another, look, these are just fake structures. They're just done to make people, you know, experience the genocide as a dialectic, rather than, you know, just straight population reduction by a group that hates them.
And right? The, of course, the role of celebrities and cults of personality, like certain political figures and celebrities, you could kind of, they're there. That's why they were created in the first place, and they were created. That's sort of Edward Bernays developed that process of the Enrique Caruso. But the Hollywood itself, with Rudolph Valentino and these things, and the creation, you know, the magazines, and that's what the function of the theaters with these, and then these celebrities can then promote whether it's products or a certain cultural agenda. Obviously, I mean, Hollywood right now. I mean. Hollywood, what it's projecting out to the United States and the entire world, for that matter. It's promoting Americanism and these things. It's an instrument for the New World Order, globalism, monoculture, and just the role, the fact that they produce or at least that the fact that so many celebrities just themselves, you know, are being promoted as people to emulate or to follow, whether it's the scandals. Their opulent lifestyle, these things you can they'll have a whole show about Katy Perry's mansion, as if why would we care about this, or who's divorcing whom, or who's having an affair with whom, or who's doing something with what, Harvey Weinstein, these things, these scandals, and everyone's talking about the exploits or the degenerate lifestyle of celebrities as if this matters to anybody.
Right. It's just kind of pornography.
Yeah.
I mean, the same way that pornography sucks the mind in and, you then start developing appetites for particular looking females and particular kinds of sexual acts, none of which are likely to happen in the real world.
Which leads to impotence, ironically.
Right. And then you end up you can't even have sex with, the real women in your life, which incidentally is becoming more and more clear, that pornography is just it's a way to compartmentalize.
And look where we're talking about Hollywood itself, but they're rolled into the military, but that's how the military is now being used to confuse these roles. Cause the recruitment of women is yet another example of them brutalizing femininity, destroying it. And marginalizing masculinity, these things, creating these problems between male and female, these things. That's probably a function of this sort of Me Too campaign. They turn Hollywood's degenerate scandals into an opportunity to promote another brand of feminism. And at the same time, they smearing all men in these things, and they create this sort of this victim narrative where all these starlets that line up to take their clothes off for roles in movies. Then they, these sex objects became raging feminists overnight, lecturing.
I'll tell you, I just wanted to say, any parent that has a kid that is studying or somehow has become enamored with the idea of being an actor or an actress, get them the hell out of acting school.
Yeah, it's horrible.
I mean, that is an absolute, grindstone to pulverize the soul of the individual. Because, look, there's no way they can succeed the people like Kardashian and Jane Fonda that are the icons that the North Star that people want to move toward. These are oligarchic structures. They're not real human beings. They were chosen, out of, these secret society needs, and your kid isn't going to make it.
Yeah, and would you want them to emulate the lifestyle of Jane Fonda?
Wouldn't want anyway. But what's going to happen is that after like 5 years of acting classes, you'll get, one role as a topless zombie whose head is eaten.
Yeah.
And that will be the career. It's just a complete soul suck. So you have to get your kid out in the same way that people have to turn Hollywood off. Just turn it off. The only thing you should be listening to is our show and a few others. But you have to go to the alternative media. I didn't mean to speak light of that, but you've got to go to the alternative media, find ways to get information, because mainstream is mainstream propaganda. Militarism is part of it. It's just, it shows up as a point in the spectrum, and people think, well, that means that, you know, some like an actress that promotes GBTL culture and pacifism shows that we're not, you know, that Hollywood has, you know, there's freedom of thought. Because on one hand, you've got people promoting militarism, and the other hand, you have, you know, GBTL and, you know, and pacifism. It's one system.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is there just to destroy ethnic community and take people into the new world order, where they are isolated from their ethnicity, from their family, and from their spouse. And the children are produced by the state. So the opposite of that is strength and virtue.
This is what kind of what we're up against. I was just reading an article. Yeah. This is from 2009, the Washington Post. The White House proposes cuts in military recruiting budget. And citing the Pentagon's recent success in meeting its manpower needs, the Obama administration is proposing to cut the defense budget, the Defense Department's budget for recruiting by nearly $800 million, or 11% for 2010. The proposed budget would reverse years of increased spending aimed at bolstering military forces strained by 6 years of combat in Iraq and nearly 8 years in Afghanistan. From 2004 to 2008, annual funding for recruiting and retention programs more than doubled from $3.4 billion to $7.7 billion. So they're spending $7.7 billion on recruitment and retention amid a deep recession that has made the military more appealing option for job seekers.
I love the double speak.
Yeah.
Because they don't have any money, it's more appealing, right? When you're starving, you know, like a piece of glyphosate-infested, you know, poison is really appealing. Because you see, this is the thing, is that people are so beaten down that, you know, by the financial, social situation, that the military is like looking like the only option. And then when they see the militarism, and it works well in terms of propaganda, as far as tugging, getting a little patriotism going on inside them, you know, they're just going to make a very bad decision. I am the poster boy for anti-recruitism. You know, there could be don't join the army kind of posters can start propping up, because, you know, it's you're just going to get in there. They're going to mess with your mind. You're going to be told stuff about the rationale for the wars. You're going to be given 9-1-1 and the crazed terrorist, concept in the Middle East. And you're just going to go over there and kill people and then come back. And at some point, there's going to be a voice inside of you that's going to say, you know, I just don't understand it. And you're just going to feel lost. And at that point, it's, you know, when you look at the militarism, Tim, and the propaganda, and then the statistic of the number of veterans who commit suicide, right? You can see that there's something wrong with the propaganda, you know?
Yeah.
Something's happening to our troops over there. They're realizing when they come back, you know, I don't know because I haven't been there, but I know the statistics of suicide are just catastrophic. And so this is a symptom to me of, you know, that their humanity can be conditioned, but they can't extinguish it. John Stewart and Noam Chomsky can make jokes or be, you know, kind of loving and avuncular and fool you. But at the end of the day, your basic humanity will pop up to the surface, and then you're going to wonder what you did, you know, with your life and your actions. And so... rather than go in and become a robot, how about just staying outside the military and working on your own strength and virtue?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we're still in a situation where, like, Bradley Manning, when he exposes a crime being committed by U.S. soldiers, people who are hemmed up on militarism and this faux patriotism, jingoism, nationalism, will call for his head rather than say, well, he exposed wrongdoing. Instead he's put into prison, subjected to God knows what, and then comes out this Chelsea Manning running for the Senate was a woman. So,
and then you get like John McCain, you know, asking for his head. Just look in the background of McCain's family. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a Masonic generational cesspool. I think they've all been admirals.
Yeah, military. And because he is the one that had that incident on that aircraft carrier. He killed a bunch of soldiers and he set some order. He was goofing off on a plane or something and he was shuffled off. Of course, his second wife, I think her father was a lieutenant for the Brofman crime family, the Jewish crime family.
Right.
And so he's connected to organized crime in these things. So.
Yeah, I mean, and so it's just the militarism, I think, is exposed. People can, there's enough available on the internet for someone to do basic work, and I'm sure realize that even if you're not as extreme in your position as, you know, come to the point where you're extreme position as I am, you realize that they are systematically using military propaganda in different ways to make the people, the public, less able to resist it.
Oh, yeah.
And so when you get to that point, you know, we need to organize ourselves in opposition to it. First step is spread the word, right? You need to tell people this is going on, and that gets back to the question of the beer drinker. You know, he's sitting there at the NFL title game. He's just popped a cylinder, and here comes the American flag covering the football field. You know,
mm-hmm.
Do you say anything? Do you say, well, this is being done to mess with our minds, you know?
Well, the Pentagon's paying the NFL to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't patriotism. It's a business proposition.
Right. And people are making decisions that will end up with, you know, with death based on, you know, this propaganda. So if you don't say anything, you know, if you just go back to the Bud Light and pull it down and wait for the kickoff, is that really strength and virtue? You know, I don't think so. I think that, you know, years from now you wonder, you know, maybe I should have said something, you know, when your children are dying in some foreign land and you know, nothing has changed in our country and we are just completely a slave state, an overt one. You know, maybe it's time where we have a little bit of freedom and free speech to say something. You know, those who are aware that this is propaganda, say something, speak out.
There was an ad for, was it the Marines? I forget. But the ad just consists of these amphibious vehicles rolling up and these soldiers running out on a beach and all running.
Yeah, thousands of them. I've seen that.
And something, they don't retreat. They go one direction. I forget what the tagline was.
Yeah, but like just, some people go forward.
Moving forward. They should show the trench scene from the film or something.
You know that it's funny. I had a similar idea when I see that. And just to flesh it out, you see thousands of American servicemen with armed to the teeth,
mm-hmm.
planes, jets, tanks. Everyone is going forward. They're all running in one direction. I've always thought that the camera should turn around and show the other side, and you'd see like a family of you know, Muslims, like a mm-hmm. a mother with two children, you know, to get an idea of what the heroism is really
about. Well, you know, what Muslims do is they put bombs in their kids' clothes and then send them to go, because that's what American Sniper was about, remember? How?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you know, this is what these people do. And, of course, no one even thinks about, where are they? A little geography. Oh, they're in Iraq. Oh, right. Wait a second. That's like 7,000-8,000 miles away. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, why are we, you know, it's so the Middle East is a, you know, it's not a puzzle. It isn't, you know, there's nothing to solve. It's just, it's chaos and it's deliberate chaos. The public are kept deliberately confused instead of some kind of clear understanding, you know, the origin of ISIS or what our military policy has brought. None of this matters. It's all terrorism, right? The terrorism is.
Well, there's never any context to this. You remember right. a while back when that
and the militarism. You know, you get the oh my God, they've blown up Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And then they'll cut to the American flag being unfurled at the football game, and they'll have like 15 guys who have one leg, you know, limp out onto the field. And give the flag salute.
Worst of some like young lady there with a missing leg, and we're supposed to be all proud about that.
Yeah, like well, that, this is
that's,
a great thing.
Proud of that. But you remember a while back when that freight ship was hijacked by the Somali pirates?
This
was
about
6-7 years ago.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, of course, the story is I think it was the U.S. Navy takes it back eventually. The snipers come in and They liberate the ship from these pirates, and that the only context we're given is the Somali pirates and this freighter, and they made a movie about it with Tom Hanks.
Right, he gets around, doesn't he?
He's everywhere, man.
He's what you call a lifetime actor.
Yeah, and remember that all that was going down. I was just saying, well, you know, really, is it the job of the U.S. Navy to protect freighters? Shouldn't freighters and their insurance companies come up with ideas to ensure the cargo and the crew, and then that be worked into the price structure and these things, and that should be the true cost of international trade. Should we be socializing the security risk of these freighters? I mean, if I had a sailing vessel, I wouldn't get the protection of the Navy. These things.
No.
So should and this no. Aren't there like countermeasures they could have and these things, and perhaps if they. And I was just this is the military. Pirates are evil, and this is a chance to celebrate our military. That was kind of the response I was getting from my siblings. It was like, this isn't the job, and it really isn't the job of the military. If they're in the area, they may. Serendipity, they may be in an area where they can do something and do some good. Like it's like relief for a storm or something. If they're there, yeah, do it. But it isn't justification for 12 aircraft carriers because sometime they might show up and relieve a country that's been hit by a hurricane. But it turns out then if you do a little research in Somalia, the geopolitics of Somalia was going on there, and how that country had been devastated by the Anglo-American Zio Empire.
Right.
The corporations that have been
British Petroleum
interests destabilizing that country, these things, and apparently that area, a lot of the corporations have been dumping their waste there and destroying the fish, the traditional fishing.
And that's what led to the so-called piracy.
But no one wants to hear about that.
Yeah,
no one wants to hear. No, you're making no. There's a context here. I mean, come on. I mean,
so there it is. It's militarism plus terrorism. So, Tim, I have to tell you something. 2 days ago, I took this long plane ride. And it is a strange thing to come back to the United States. It is very odd. This whole thing at the airport, I'm seeing it as a replication of the feudal system where one of the first things they did when they set it up was reduce or almost make impossible travel.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone had to stay put. Everyone had to stay in place. That was my sense of it. Is that when you come back to the United States, it's like, welcome to the feudal system. And then of course, militarism was promoted tremendously by Rome. It was one of the first propaganda campaigns with all of the fancy standards and divine, aspects of the military.
The tribute, the parade, right?
Yeah. So it's this is longstanding technique to get the, hoi polloi to give up their blood. Let's stop this. It's just ridiculous, we need to spread the information, Tim.
Yeah. And so. It reminds me of that scene, the closing scene of the movie Patton, which is supposedly an anti-war movie. It ended up being very popular at the time. It's a great movie, cinematography. It's a great movie. And it turns out Patton might have been assassinated anyway. So, because he was opposing the post-war agenda. But that scene where he goes for hundreds of years in Rome, victorious generals would be brought back to Rome and given a tribute, a parade. From all around the empire, slaves would be brought in. And animals from the empire and these things, and to thousands of cheering. And behind him, in his chariot, riding with the general, would be a slave whispering into his ears, "Glory is fleeting."
So, yeah, well, it's great. You know, the secret society, you know, they kicked the slave out of the chariot.
Yeah.
And, you know, they want it permanently. So
and also meant that for years, Romans, you couldn't bring the army across the Rubicon. And so that was
Thing. It's like the U.S. military, you know, it's just becoming part of the police department. You know, but okay, so it's you know, like goes.
Well, yeah, it's another thing. You look at the police. Look at that. All that is a large function of that is just because all the hardware that the military industrial complex produces, they got to sell it to somebody. Then they create markets for it, and of course, the one market is the increasingly militarized a police force. So every town has a bearcat, a tank, and these things. So, you know,
God, you've just set my brain spinning like a pinwheel. I can't handle it because I'm too jet lagged.
Okay,
all right, brother. Listen, great talk. Thank you so much. Next week it's going to be fantastic, folks. So be sure to tune in.
Okay, great. Yeah, we'll get together next week, and of course, Joe, have a nice weekend and getting your life back together.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I hope I can. I'm going to try to get used to the U.S. slowly here. It's not easy to do.
Have you been debriefed? No, anyway.
No, right. I mean, that's what I was waiting for. Yeah, like they need to debrief me when I came in. Oh, man. All right, Tim.
Okay.
Thank you, brother.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.